Welcome to Follow Your Curiosity, Ordinary People, Extraordinary Creativity. Here's how to get unstuck. I'm your host, creativity coach, Nancy Norbeck. Let's go. My guest this week, Dominic Shortino, is a creative powerhouse. By day, he's a barber. Much of the rest of the time, he's an artist, musician, and now a talent buyer for a local entertainment venue in Pennsylvania. Dom was one of my first guests on the podcast, and I'm thrilled to have him back to talk about the intersection of art and commerce, with stops at creative courage, specifically the courage to fail in and with a crowd, why you should always aim to please yourself first with your creative work, even if you want to sell it, the effects of ignoring our creative call, and just what happens behind the scenes of the performing arts, especially on the money side. Here's my conversation with Dominic Shortino. Dominic, welcome back to Follow Your Curiosity.
Well, thank you for having me again. I appreciate it, Nancy.
Always. We won't go through all of the "were you a creative kid" stuff, since this is a return visit, and anyone who has not heard your first episode should go back and listen to it because it's awesome.
Thank you.
One of the first that I did, and still one of my favorites. So.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you, Nancy.
Well, you are such an amazing advocate for the arts, and it shows so much in that episode. And so I'm really curious to hear what the heck you've been up to, because I know you said you have a lot to say about art and commerce.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, we could get into that. I create art and in a lot of different ways. And, you know, whether it's good or not is subjective, I guess. But the important thing is we should all be doing it. So we should be creating something. So I tend to put my fingers in a lot to see what sticks. And unfortunately or fortunately, a lot of it is sticking. So I find myself doing a lot of things. And it's very fulfilling. So music, of course. I'm still in a Beastie Boys tribute, and we play a handful of times a year because we could do a whole podcast on the Beastie Boys if you ever want to do that. But I also kind of rolled out doing acoustic stuff, just me and my guitar. I did it online, and now I'm taking it public again. And it's kind of a really unique thing. I just take requests, and some of them I know and that I've played before, but others, if I know how it goes, the rule is I have to pull it up on my computer and try to play it. Pull the chords up. And that's just kind of a lot of fun. And I'm adding a new piece to that. I'm doing it next month at a local venue, and we're making it karaoke as well. So not only can you request a song, you can come up and sing it with me, and we could all just fail miserably or nail it, or both, depending on what part of the song we're in. And then in my little bit of spare time beyond that, I've really discovered pen and watercolor ink again. I actually made my wife two paintings for her birthday, which is the first completed works paint-wise that I've done in, 30 years probably.
Wow.
So that was very fulfilling, yeah. Just pen and watercolor. One was of our three cats, and one was of the Tree of Life. And it was fun.
Cool.
It was so fun. You know, to frame it and be like, oh, I created something else.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's... for her, they will hang in our home, but obviously I'm not looking to go beyond that. But, you know, kind of dovetailing on what we're going to talk about today, it's personal and, you know, not for sale. And yet it's one of the most fulfilling things I've done in the last 6 months, you know, that and just creating.
Yeah. Well, and can we talk for a second about the amount of sheer courage that it takes to say, if I don't know this song and I can find it on my computer, I'm going to sit here and try to play it for you because you asked for it in front of people?
Well, thank you so much. That's kind of the whole point of it. It's when you make an ass of yourself, you kind of level the playing field because everybody in the audience is just like, oh, he messed up. You know, I can mess up too. And when you get everybody in on that act, rather than a very structured, you know, the lights, the fog machine, you know, everything is just, It's still art, but it's very structured. It's like a play. It's, you know, concerts are just, you know, very, this is going to happen and this is going to happen. The spontaneity is really where a lot of really great things get created.
You know, you may have just explained why I've always liked rehearsals better than performance.
Oh, wow. Interesting. Yeah.
I've never been able to put my finger on it before, but maybe that's it, because the performance is like, this is it. And it has to be good.
Yeah.
It has to be perfect. And there are people who paid to come and hear you and, you know, whatever. But the rehearsal, anything can happen.
Absolutely. And yeah, that's where the magic happens, right? Because
yeah,
things can change too. Like, you know, if the artist is there and says, I like this line better, why don't you say it like that? You know? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and that's just true in life, that it's, they always say, you know, it's not the destination, it's the journey. But
yeah,
yeah, that's, it's the most fun I have performing, is doing these live requests, because I don't know. Yeah. And it was terrifying. I just did it online, which is so easy because you don't hear the applause. You don't hear the, you know, but when I started to do it out, you know, there's the big, is this going to work? And it always does, because the people feel like they're a part of it. They're helping create this thing, as opposed to just observers.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I think it was my mom, when I first had to do like piano recital kind of stuff, which scared the crap out of me as a kid. I remember her telling me two things. The first was, keep going if you make a mistake, because nobody is sitting there with a copy of the score keeping track. As I'm older, I find that a little bit harder to believe, because, you know, people know pieces of music.
Right,
you know?
Right, exactly.
But if you keep going, then at least you're not just falling apart when it happens. And it happens to everybody.
Absolutely.
But if it wasn't her, I don't know who it was, who said, you know, like, your audience is on your side. You,
oh,
you get
yeah.
up like with all the
so
stage
true.
Fright and everything, and you're terrified because you're scared to death that you're going to screw up in front of these people and they're going to think terrible things about you. But the fact is, if you stop and think about it, you know, any time that you've been in an audience, did you ever want that person to fall flat on their face? You never want that person to fall flat on your face. You want them.
There are some people that come with a chip on their shoulder,
yeah.
but we're not going to focus on that, but 5 to 10%.
90-some
right,
percent of people came to hear you do something
right.
awesome. They want you
Absolutely.
To succeed. And so, like, if they're on your side, then it makes sense to me that if you have the guts to get up there and say, I don't know this, I have no idea if I can play it, but I'll try.
Yeah.
Then, you know, when you mentioned like the karaoke thing and whatever, I can totally see where you would end up with an entire room that suddenly is just like, yeah, man, we're all going to sing and we're going to get up and dance and we're going to whatever, because this
right.
is the moment and we're celebrating the fact that we don't have to be perfect and let's just go. Which just feels amazing to me, just imagining it in my head.
There's a great clip you can go and look up of Billy Joel when he started his Madison Square Garden residency. I don't know how far he was into it, but I know he used to be a heavy drinker and he's cleaned himself up. But when he was still in that drinking phase, he does We Didn't Start the Fire, which of course the whole crowd is waiting for in Madison Square Garden, and he forgets the words. And the entire audience picks him up. And he just steps away from the mic and lets him do it. And everybody, you know, and these people paid $200 to see this and they didn't care. They're like, oh, we got you. You know,
well, yeah, because now it's their moment too.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah. It's absolutely.
They're the show now. It's all a joint effort. I think we forget how much art and performance in particular, but, you know, even if you're just going to a museum and looking at a piece of art, you're part of what's going on there. You know, your interpretation, your reaction is part of the art. It's not a static thing. We're all part of whatever we're partaking of.
I just, changing course a little bit, like, I've been listening to a lot of Alan Watts. I don't know if you're familiar
Ooh,
with him.
Yeah.
So... they put his lectures online, and he's a fascinating character. But, you know, and I just actually posted this to my social media yesterday because it was such a beautiful thing from a talk he gave from the 60s where he says, you know, the entire world as it is would not exist without you in it. and you would not exist as you are without the entire world. You know, it's all connected. So you take one piece out and the whole house of cards falls and becomes a different thing. So absolutely, when you're observing something, when you're listening, when you're singing along in your car, scientifically, you can't prove that you're, you know, contributing anything, but it's true. Like it's all part of that. Same John Frusciante from the Red Hot Chili Peppers, he deflects any praise about his playing and songwriting. He says, I'm just tapping into a source we all have access to. You know, I'm just a vessel. And that's so beautiful to me, you know, that to acknowledge that there's just this source of creation. You can't deny it, even if you're not spiritual. You know, it's inexplicable how things work like that, how you create things.
Yeah. Yeah. And there was, I've talked about this a couple of times, but not a whole lot. There was a moment about, it was like the fall of 2020, I think. And I did a guided meditation one morning, and it was, normally I have trouble focusing even on a guided meditation, right? Like I am not a natural meditator, anything like that.
Yep.
But that morning, I don't know what was different, and I have never been able to replicate it, which is annoying, but hey, maybe I'll get lucky sometime. But I just suddenly had this vision of how there's this creative life force and each of us has a spark of it. And that every time we engage with it, we feel most alive because we are most in touch with that overall creative life force that, you know, makes the grass grow and the birds sing and whatever. And that's what really makes us feel most alive. And it was one of those things where I was so glad that I had time afterwards to sit down. I spent like half an hour writing this thing down. And I'm so glad I did, because, you know, what I just told you is a tiny piece of it, but that's like what I remember when I haven't reread it recently. But it was just like, whoa, yeah. Yeah, that makes sense to me.
You know,
it's kind of like that Robin Williams quote about you only have one little spark of madness. Yeah, it's the same thing, right?
Yeah.
We are each a part of this bigger thing. And that's why when we do our thing, we don't necessarily know we're connecting to that thing, but that's what we're doing. And that's why it lights us up and makes us feel alive.
It's so true, because I think it's Edward Muir, M-U-I-R. Do you know that name?
He's
a scientist. We go down to Chincoteague Island, and at the Visitor Center, they have a big quote on his wall. It's like, when you try to pluck something out of the universe, you find it inexplicably connected to everything else.
Mm.
And, you know, it all works together somehow. And when we do not, and I'm not saying anybody should, you know, make music, make art. You must create in some way to tap into that. And if you don't, I truly believe you feel alienated. You feel alienated from that source if you're not connected. And it doesn't have to be a specific religion. But if you feel alienated, what are you going to be like? You're going to be hostile, right? You're not going to be happy. I think it's so important. You know, the biggest lie we've been told is that we're not connected to everything. And so much as even the dialogue we use is like, we conquer nature, right?
Right, right.
Why are we conquering something that we're a part of?
Right. You know, we need.
Yes. And so I think it's so important. Meditation, just listening to birds. There's a book I saw in a greenhouse store that somebody actually took songbirds, recorded their singing, and then wrote it out musically. And I should have bought it. I got to go back and buy it. But it's, if you're a musician, you look at it, you're like, what the hell's going on here? Like, you couldn't play it. You know what I mean? And this bird just effortlessly, you know, does that.
Yeah.
And it's a song. It's beautiful. Like, yeah, there's, I just mystical. I just love it.
Yeah, there's a definite mystical, spiritual side to creativity. And there's also, you know, like what you were saying, I think I've been thinking about this a lot lately. In fact, I just wrote a whole thing about lapsed creativity, because, you know, that's what happens. Like, we get into this state where we're like, oh, you know, I always wanted to go audition for a play, or I always wanted to just pick up a cheap watercolor set and play with it.
Oh,
like I
yeah.
did when I was a kid, or whatever. But, you know, like, we tend to indulge more of that stuff when we're young, before you have the job and the family and all of that stuff, or you have the professor who tells you, man, you're never going to be a good watercolor artist, just pack it up and go home, you know, or the parents who are like, you know, you can't do that. You need to, like, you know, be a lawyer, or, you know, a plumber, or something that makes money. And then you spend your whole day doing the thing that makes you the money, and you come home and you're completely drained, and you have no energy to do anything beyond feed yourself and your kids and put everybody to bed, right? And over time, like you say, you know, you lose touch with this really important part of yourself. And it takes a toll. You may not realize what it is that's like making you feel disconnected, or, you know, anxious, or whatever it is. But odds are really good, if you haven't connected with your creative side recently, that's part of it at the very least. And the irony that people don't realize too is that even if you just do a couple minutes of something creative every day, it's enough to counteract that. And you end up with more energy because you feel so much better about yourself and the fact that you've done something and that you're reconnecting with that part.
Boom. So I see where you're going here with the whole commerce thing. But it's so true, because they, you know, there's this cliche, do what you love and the money will follow, which is, you know, we don't want to get into capitalism and healthcare and all that.
Yeah.
But there's so much truth in that statement, because I found if you're truly doing what you love, and you're happy, you actually need less money, because a lot of that money you're spending is on things that are trying to make you happy. You know what I mean? And they don't, you know, that empty materialism. But if you are so driven doing what you love, you forget about those new shoes. You forget about that new car. And you just like, I'm really happy with what I have because I'm doing what, there's so much truth to that.
Yeah, you're not trying to fill that empty space inside you with things that can't fill it, because you're doing the thing that fills it.
Right, exactly.
You know? And I mean, I've heard it said, you know, before, like, creativity is not therapy, but boy, is it therapeutic.
Oh, yeah, creativity is not therapy. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. A lot of it is, right? It is therapeutic.
Yeah.
Just writing down thoughts is, you know, you're creating.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Even if you never share it with anybody.
That's absolutely right.
If you never make a dime for it, if you end up with a stash of random watercolor pages tucked away in the back of your closet, it's still better than not doing it, because you're doing the thing you love doing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But the surprising thing is, when you do so show, you know, people things, and you get that praise, and sometimes they're like, I would pay for that.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. Like,
and you talk about overcoming that stage fright, that fear. It's yourself telling you lies that this does not belong. Nobody needs this. Yeah, no, you need it. But somebody else might too. Like, you know?
Yeah. But, and you know what's funny though, is when I say that whatever you create, you need to create for yourself first. You know, you shouldn't be creating it saying, you know, oh, I need to buy a new car, so I'm going to create something that's going to make me enough money to buy a new car, right? Because as soon as you do that, you lose touch with that part of yourself that's so important. And I said that online a couple of years ago, and somebody like came down on me and would not stop saying that, like, that, you know, how dare I say that you shouldn't make any money from your art? And what if you need to pay your rent? And I mean, and it just went on. And I'm like, no, I'm not saying don't sell your art. What I'm saying is, if you create what you need to create that makes you happy, your odds of making something that other people are going to want to buy are so much higher, because you've made something that's authentic. You haven't tried to please the, you know, proverbial focus group that always ruins the movie that should have been better, right? Because, the focus group didn't like the ending, so we changed the ending, and, you know, now everybody hates the movie. It's the same thing, right? If you make your own strange little troll figures that, you know, like, I probably would think were weird, but I knew somebody who was, like, really into these things. And I was like, okay, this person who makes these things is making something that I don't understand, but they're not for me. Right? They're for her. And then all of these other people who like that kind of stuff, they're for them too. Your stuff doesn't have to be for everybody. It doesn't have to, you know, please everybody. You're never going to find something that has an audience of 100% of the population, ever.
No. No.
Never.
But exactly. I love it. It's going into the arts is crazy because of that commerce piece. Like we, like we were saying, then that's because in my opinion, art was never meant to be commerce. It's a whole different animal, you know? So, however, sometimes you do have to say, I do need to make money. And people, you talk about bringing the audience in, you know, the people will pay for it because they know you need money to do that stuff. And that's really a beautiful thing.
Yeah. I mean, in that sense, payment that's, is a and sign that's of why, appreciation. That's why
grants are so important. You know, Cormac McCarthy, Blood Meridian, I just read it recently for the first time, which is just a horrifying book. But every sentence was like a poem. And he really studied, I don't know if you know anything about the book. It's brutal. Mm-hmm. It's about Americans and Native Americans fighting in the border, Civil War. And he was an auto mechanic. Like, even after his first couple of novels, that's what he did. But when he wrote his border trilogy, which was All the Pretty Horses, and I don't remember all the books, where it was this era and he studied it, he received a grant. And he worked on these books for 10 years. And that changed everything when it freed him up to create that. And he became probably the most revered American author in recent memory, you know, of our generation. When the government can step up and say, we're going to give you this money to create, it's such a beautiful thing.
Oh, yeah.
You know, to lessen that burden on somebody who really has a vision and is not necessarily accomplished, you know, is not... paint by numbers, the greatest artist, but just has this vision that drives them so much. It's like, I need to create this all the time. And yeah, there's an example of that.
Yeah.
And which is why, I mean, not going too far down this road, why a minimum basic income would just be so helpful for everybody to pursue. I understand we still need dishwashers. We still need, you know, carpenters. Right. I get that. But there's some people that speaks to. But then there's a portion of the population that is slaving away at menial jobs just so they can play in a band on a weekend or, you know, paint or do pet therapy, dog sit, like whatever is speaking to them.
Well, and as AI, and we could go down a whole rabbit hole there, and I don't think we should, because that's a whole other conversation. But, you know, as that starts taking over, you know, I mean, I'm already hearing that, like, entry-level writing jobs are disappearing because companies have decided that ChatGPT is free. So why do they need to pay?
Okay, so we won't go down that rabbit hole, but I have a big opinion on that.
And, me too.
Right? So it's interesting that, you know, Spotify, and I don't know the exact numbers, but not to call out Spotify, but they gained like 16 million new subscribers last year. But they laid off like 11% of the workforce. Now, how do you grow as a company? But so you know what happened there is there's a computer doing what human beings, you know, data. Mm-hmm. That's music, right? You have AI creating paintings and art. You know, in our perfect sci-fi vision of the future, the robots would do all the crap jobs. Mm-hmm. So we would be free to pursue art. But what's happening, right?
Yeah.
The computers are doing all the art while we're left. And there's a reason for that. And it's a horrifying reason is that because humans doing menial jobs is cheaper than robots. Think about that, right? Yeah. It's cheaper to put a person behind a machine. Well, you know, barbering, which I do as a vocation, Like, there's no way a robot, there's just not enough money in it. So, you know, some of these people in these chain hair salons are left doing, you know, what some might call menial work for $7.25 an hour, while a robot is making a painting or mining data about music and who wants to listen to what, which should be. And that's really fascinating too, because I am a Spotify listener, full disclosure. And at work, we'll just put on a playlist. What we do is we'll pick up somebody's favorite band or artist that day and put on a playlist of that, or a radio station. So it's multiple artists that kind of are in that genre. The human-made playlists on Spotify, like you or I can make a playlist of, let's say we're Queen fans, and on that playlist would be Queen and Elton John and Billy Joel. And, you know, the human-made playlists are always better than the Spotify recommended, because it's a computer saying, well, you like Queen, so we're also going to play Molly Hatchet because they were from the same era, but they're obviously completely different bands. Whereas the human playlist is like, oh yeah, this goes well with this, this goes well with this. So hopefully that will work itself out, and we'll realize that art needs human interaction to be beautiful.
I mean, art is a fundamentally human thing. So to think that a machine could create art that can compete in any way with something human created just seems right on its face to me to be completely laughable.
Right, exactly.
And, you know, getting back to the whole art and commerce idea, I mean, you talk about Spotify. You know, who even gets paid anything on Spotify?
Believe me, I feel guilty every time I press play. I do. But being such a music nut and having everything available to me, I mean, I'd be willing to pay more monthly than I do, you know? And there's ways during COVID, it's gone away now, but on Spotify, you would play an artist, you know, an independent artist, and there would be a button that said donate to this artist, you know, because they knew they weren't touring. And
see,
it's
that's
like,
what you need.
Absolutely. Yeah. Click, click, click. I'll spend $10 on that. I'll spend $5 on this, whatever.
Yeah.
So, but I think it was COVID only, and I haven't seen it recently on Spotify.
That's a shame, especially it since, is. You know, wasn't there something like toward the end of the year where it was like they were going to change and certain artists, they just weren't going to pay at all? And it's like, how do you look in the mirror knowing that you are making money off of these people and they're getting paid nothing?
Nothing.
You know, it's like the whole, oh, come play at our event, we can't pay you, but you'll get exposure argument, you know?
Isn't that fascinating that that's the only industry that happens in?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, come fix my sink and I will give 100 of your business cards away and tell you what a great job. No plumber's going to do that. Like, so
no,
why do you expect a musician to do that?
Right. Or a dancer or whoever.
Do you want to play here? Then you need to sell this many tickets. Here's the tickets. You sell them. You know, if you want to work on my fridge, you have to, you know, like, we don't do that in any other industry. Well, I guess because art isn't an industry. I shouldn't call it an industry, but it is in America. I mean,
but also, I mean, and this is part of what goes into that whole lapsed creativity thing I was talking about before. You know, you have this whole cultural idea that art and creativity are a luxury, you know, and they're not a luxury. They're a necessity. Imagine your life if you had no music, no art on your walls, nothing to watch on TV, no movies to go to, you know, didn't have a camera and nobody else did either. You know, imagine all of your clothes were just the same boring thing every day because there was no fashion design, right?
So my oldest son went into theater, his degree is in theater arts. My middle son is studying music and audio engineering. And I would get that comment a lot from people, well, what's he going to do with that degree, especially the theater arts degree? And I remember seeing a quote saying, you can't say, how can you make money in this industry and then spend all your free time consuming art?
Right.
It's like, that's what are you doing when you get, you know, Netflix? It's art. Movies are art. Right. Shows are art, you know? So that's what everybody's doing every night. Or you're reading a book, or you're going to a movie, or you're listening, you know. So
yeah,
there's jobs in these industries, you know.
You may have to make your own, but still, I know people who've done that, you know. I mean, there are people with theater degrees who train people in public speaking or sales techniques or, you know, all of that, because there's so much performance in it. You can apply those things in places that are not necessarily, you know, a Broadway theater.
Right,
and
exactly.
We don't think about that either. So we just continue to devalue this stuff.
Absolutely. Audio and engineering, there is more vocations available with streaming and the internet than there's ever been. Even churches, for you know, mega churches need somebody to mix that sound. It's like, it's all over the place. But yeah, I guess that's, you know, I always feel terrible just talking poorly about that 5%, 10% of the population. But it is, you're just kind of stuck in this mode where, oh, that's not important, you know?
Yeah.
But then you use it, you do it, it speaks to you. Of course it's important.
Of course it's important. And there was, and it's funny because I went and looked for this recently on YouTube and I couldn't find it, but I remember it. So I assume I didn't just imagine it. There, when VH1 was doing its big Save the Music campaign, which I don't know, maybe they
could do. Yes,
And, you know, because arts funding was getting cut in schools, they had a promo that had a kid like walking down the street with his mom and like making snarky comments at like street artists and street performers, because there was, you know, in that world, there was no arts education. And so the kid was just like, eh, whatever. You know,
wow.
And when you saw that, it was just like, whoa, that is so unnatural. I mean, that's almost inhuman, because we are wired to create and to create art in specific. But it really, it brought the point home in such a strong way. It's like, do you really want your kid to be, you know, listening to music and going, this is a waste of my
time. This isn't important. Yeah.
You know, or do you want that to, you know, be you? Do you want them to grow up into somebody who is like that with their kids? Of course you don't.
Right.
So can we acknowledge that this is an important thing? Yeah.
And that some of your money might have to go towards it. You know, maybe more than you think it's worth. Actually, there's a great documentary. It was on HBO a couple years ago called The Price of Everything. Did you watch that?
No.
It's primarily, well, I shouldn't name the artist, but it's about an artist that I guess was an investor, like a blue chip, like made a lot of money and then started making really huge statues of shiny balloon animals.
Mm.
Yeah. And just about the price of art and how it's now, you know, investors are buying these priceless pieces of art, $10 million for a Picasso, whatever, and it's not leaving their homes, you know, and the museums can't afford it. So there's these pieces you won't see. And, but they're talking about how that artist was, he just comes up with an idea and then has a factory does it. Like he's not even hands-on because he knows it's worth $1 million, $2 million, $3 million because it's a product, as opposed to, you know, when a lot of the artists like Picasso were, you know, they never expected, you know, and it's the same way with guitars from like the 50s and 60s. You know, those things were meant to be played. They're the craftsmanship. And yet these investors are buying them, putting them behind Lucite cases, you know, and they don't. If you go to their home, you can look at them, but you certainly can't touch them.
Yeah.
But anyways, The Price of Everything is the documentary and very interesting about that. Just, but they're also saying the fact that these paintings are fetching this amount of money means it is worth something to these people. So it's a double-edged sword, even though it's terrible, but people are willing to pay, not just for status, but because the thing is obviously beautiful and very personal, creative expression on somebody's part that it speaks to us somewhere. So millionaires are willing to pay a lot of money for it.
It's crazy. It's crazy.
Right. Yeah.
You know, it's like creativity is okay if it's linked with celebrity, you know, or something like that.
Yes.
But if it's not and you're just, you know, Joe Schmo who works in a bank all day, then, oh, hey, no, that's not for you.
Right. Exactly.
Which is so backwards.
It is.
It's so backwards.
It is.
So I know you've been doing more at the actual intersection of art and commerce, and I want to make sure that we get a chance to talk about that. Like, what exactly have you been doing?
It is awful. It's
That's
so
an encouraging
awful
way to start.
You know, first of all, so there's a local venue, a concert venue. It's large. It holds like 800 people. And I am the entertainment director, which means I book all the talent. And in the industry, the title for that is actually talent buyer. So you talk about that commerce. And it's hard. It's really, I mean, I love it because I get to bring these bands in and singers in and artists and see a concert practically every weekend if I want to. But it's hard for me to put a price tag on what some of these people are doing. You know what I mean? And the stuff that makes money is tributes. People want to see a tribute to Bon Jovi or a tribute to whatever band. So I have to, and they're really, I have no problem with tributes. I just think it's, I'm in one myself.
I was going to say, you're in one.
Yeah. But it's sad that that's what sells. You know, people will not take a chance on somebody they've never heard. Most people won't.
A lot of that is Gen X nostalgia, I think.
Oh yeah, the nostalgias. Yeah, but what I so I have to sit down, and I have to think about how many tickets is this artist going to sell, and what are we going to sell them at, and that's the offer I give to them, and every single time, it's too low. I think this artist deserves double that, but that's where that commerce piece comes in. But it's been fascinating doing this because I've been with this venue from the get-go, 18 months, and I saw the blood, sweat, and tears and money that went into this. And, you know, we sell alcohol. And I remember playing in bands for years. The ethic was, oh, well, that bar owner is rolling in it. They can definitely afford to pay their artists more, and you would try to push that contract as hard as possible, as high as possible. You would, if you were getting a door deal where you get the tickets at the door, or at least 80% of them, you would put somebody with a counter there to make sure the bartender was being honest, you know. And it's been fascinating now being on the other side of the bar and saying, yeah, like all those years I thought that person was rolling in it might not have been true.
Yeah.
And it's been an eye opener, you know, and now I play both sides of the coin, and beautifully it's a more balanced view. I know, you know, what things cost. I know how much venues cost to build and sound systems, and there's, you know, yeah, so there's that. So now I kind of see both sides of it, but I wish I could pay. I almost say that to every artist, like, this should be more, but this is what we can do. Nobody's walked away unhappy.
Well, that's
maybe
good.
One or two, you know, but there was a local band that plays on and off. It's probably my favorite band we've had in there. The music is just beautiful. He sings all about growing up in York County and Red Lion and the Susquehanna River. And, I knew it wasn't good because they don't tour regularly. They don't have a lot of albums out, et cetera, et cetera. They ended up bringing like 130 people on a random Thursday night, which is really fantastic for this part of the county. And he chose to, he's like, we don't do this regularly. We don't do it often, blah, blah, blah. He chose to give all that money to like the Susquehanna River Rescue and Red Lion Roars to support Red Lion. And he's like, I'm not worried about what we bring in. And I remember sending him an email the Monday after show, like, you know, everybody comes here and wants something. You were the first person that gave us something. And I'm not saying that people should pay for free or play for free. Not saying that at all. But to be aware of that situation, what things cost, you know. Now, we did pay him, obviously. We're like, we have to give you something, you know. Mm-hmm. But it took that pressure off of you have to sell 500 tickets at this price. And that's the part of it I hate. I absolutely hate.
Yeah. So I've always wondered, because I think I had heard at some point that generally speaking, ticket prices are like the fee for the artist divided by the number of seats or where the seats are, some kind of calculus, since seats prices are not usually the same for the entire house. Is that right, or am I totally wrong about that?
So as far as what the artist gets compensated, you mean?
Or like what you pay to go see them.
Yeah, that's all directly tied. So if you have a national touring artist, they have a fee, and that's it. And that's, for the most part, non-negotiable. But sometimes if they're routing through and they're playing Monday in this town and they're playing Thursday in this town and they need to fill that Tuesday or Wednesday, they will lower that fee. So most of the time, the house needs to like make a little money for security, the sound tech, what they call front of house, the light show. So that needs to be covered in the ticket price. And then ultimately, in a perfect world, the rest of that money would go to the artist. But it's not always that way. You know, it's a lot of times there's a 50-50 ticket split where the artist gets 50% and the house gets 50% because it's just cost so much to put on a show to keep mm-hmm. a venue open. But yeah, you can, yeah, it's like industry secrets. Like you can pretty much, if you see what an artist is charging for a show and you see how many seats are in that place and you figure if they're really popular and they'll sell it out or 80%, you can kind of figure out, you know, how much money's coming through the door and then, you know, what that artist is probably making.
Wow.
And it's such a small percentage of people that are not only making a living off of it, but actually living very comfortable off of it. Mm. You know, it's such a small percentage of musicians, right?
And that's got to be even worse now. Like getting back to Spotify's not paying artists. I mean, what is it like a hundredth of a cent or something?
It's like 0.0035 or something. Yeah. It's terrible.
So it's not like, you know, back when we were kids and you'd, you know, go down to the mall and buy the album. And so, yeah, some of the money from that went to the store and some of it went to the record company and some of it went to
yes.
the artist, right? And it probably still wasn't a super great deal for an artist.
It was,
but it was
basically
better than
a dollar an album is so, usually what it came to.
Yeah. So, you know, now more than ever before, you're hoping to make up your money off of your tour.
Absolutely.
You know, and maybe merchandise and whatever, but it's like, it's not even coming from the music itself. It's coming from the things that you can do on top of the music, because otherwise, you know, how many people have to listen to a song at, you know, hundredths of a cent for you even to earn a dollar?
So the internet has changed that, because now artists can just be like, here's our album, take it and come see us perform, because it's just cheaper for them. They can make an album for $500, put it on the internet and say, come see us open for this band. And that's what they want, because that's where they're making their money.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating story about the band Wilco. They called it the Great Rock and Roll Swindle. Wilco was one on the cusp of being one of the hottest independent bands in the late 80s or in the late 90s, pardon me. And Warner Brothers was really pushing them. They were very Americana. So they're like, this is the next Tom Petty. This is the next, you know, whatever, Fleetwood Mac. And Jeff Tweedy, for his album Yankee Hotel Foxtrot, he just did a hard left turn. And it was really like ambient. And it was still folk Americana. But he brought in this producer from Chicago who was really into like the art sound of the 70s. And it just was weird. It's one of my favorite albums of all times. But when they brought it to Warner Brothers, is like, where's the single? Well, just pick one. Well, none of them are singles. So normally that product is, I called it product, that's terrible, is property of the record company. But as it were, Warner Brothers was like, we don't want this right now. We're just going to let you have it. So they put it online. They're like, here it is. It's free. And we're going to do a tour. But surprisingly, because Warner dropped them and they were one of the hottest bands coming up, they received no less than 30, 35 offers from other independent labels and bigger labels to pick up the album and support the tour and this and that. And they went with None Such Records. So Warner Brothers already paid them for the album. It was not much, like $50,000.
Mm-hmm.
None Such Records came through and offered them $35,000. And Jeff Tweedy even admitted, I went with None Such. And he said, simply because they are a subsidiary of Warner Brothers. So he got paid for the same album twice. And he was going to give it away. And he did it because None Such was independent, but it was also a subsidiary. So he's like, it was the great rock and roll swindler, and just kind of exposed.
Good for him.
There's an entire documentary on it called I Am Trying to Break Your Heart. It's a great movie if you're a fan of Wilco.
Good for him.
Yeah, I know. It's hilarious.
Yeah.
And he's still one of the top touring independent artists, him and his band. They do very well.
Yeah.
Great album. You should go listen to Yankee Hotel Foxtrot. You should go listen to that album.
I'll go find it.
Yeah.
But yeah, oh,
I'll send you a Spotify link. You already got paid. It's fine.
No, well, we'll put it in the show notes. So it's all good.
There you go. Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
But no, I mean, I think if you can come up with creative ways around the limitations and the situations and all of that, you can still find ways to, you know, be a successful artist in that sense, you know, have your album, have your tour, have whatever. But I definitely think it takes a lot more ingenuity to come up with ways to make that work now than it used to.
Well, that's why most artists, even little ones, have agents, because they're artists. They don't want to deal with that garbage. They don't want to deal with crunching numbers. They want somebody to do it for them. Tell us, you know.
Well, and all the intellectual property law aspects of it, too. I wouldn't want to have to deal with
that. Yeah. Yeah, I would tell you, it's crazy because marketing is, if you have a good band or a good artist, it all hinges on marketing. Like, the data doesn't lie. Like, if you spend this much promoting a show, you will get this many people. It's almost... if it is an artist that is known or at least semi-known. I just can't stand that. that whole part of it.
It makes me think about how, you know, because it's true. And I think, and I don't know, I'm spitballing here based on my own experience, but, you know, the whole Field of Dreams, if you build it, they will come thing.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Like, in that movie, does he have to market anything? I mean, he really doesn't. And part of it's because the entire town thinks that he's crazy because he's, you know, building a baseball field on his farm. So, okay, so there's some word of mouth going on there. But he's not doing anything else. You know, I remember when I put up my first website and thought as soon as I had a website, the whole internet was going to find me.
Yeah,
imagine my shock when it didn't. You know, I mean, that is not it. You can build it, but if you don't have a way of telling people about it,
let's be honest about marketing. Most of it is manipulative.
An awful lot
right?
of it.
Mm-hmm. It's FOMO. You know what FOMO means, right?
Yep.
Fear of missing out. And whether it's a concert or, you know, you're playing on that. And I remember having a conversation with a marketer, and I kind of broached that subject with her. She says, I think about it every day and it bothers me.
That it couldn't.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure that there are people who aren't bothered by that, but I certainly would be.
Well, I think the people that aren't bothered are like, well, they'll just be spending their money somewhere else, which is a valid point.
Guess,
but like, let us tell you, this is a better place to spend your money. I don't know. I just like the more organic kind of word of mouth.
Mm-hmm.
This was an amazing art exhibit. This was an amazing concert. You should come with me next time. Like, that's just beautiful. But that does not sell tickets as much as, hey, you must see this. It's a limited time only.
Right. It's limited because we want to create a sense of scarcity that makes you buy the ticket.
And scarcity is like, we know that that's a horrible mindset, right? That causes, like the meme says, that causes the kid at the pizza party to take three pieces instead of one, instead of cutting them up and sharing them. Scarcity, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas the truth is you're not going to starve, kid. So, but it's just kind of baked into us. I don't know. I can't say we're born like that. I just like, you know,
yeah,
it's baked into
we're born
us
like that.
From the I don't think so either.
We're around so much scarcity-based marketing, you know?
Right.
Or, like, you know, our generation had grandparents that grew up during the Depression.
Oh, you know? So true.
I mean, my grandmother, when we had to clean out their house, the number of, like, pairs of shoes that were still in the boxes that she had never worn.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, the clothes that still had the tags on them.
Absolutely.
Because I think if you grow up with that, you're terrified of that ever happening again. And some of that mindset gets passed down. So, you know, we're probably passing it on to the next generation because we grew up having it passed on to us, you know?
If they announce snow, what happens, right? If they announce snow on the weather report, what happens? We rush to, I don't know about you, but I clean out the shelves. And I know I am the pinnacle of privilege in this country. I'm a white man, but I have enough food in my cabinets to last me months. Like if I emptied every can of beans and everything, but I don't have what that one thing I want. I really wanted Little Debbie's. And if
the
odds that sold out,
the odds that that snow is going to keep you in your house for two solid weeks and you can't get out are so small. But they might.
But isn't it funny that scarcity doesn't even bother us with art? Like we never use the thing like, oh, if you don't pay these artists enough, they're not going to make stuff and they're going to go away. And like, when people are like, oh, well, I'll find something else. You know what I mean? But you know, whereas it should be, hey, this is unique. This is special. Right. You should spend your time on this. You should compensate this person. You should promote it. You should, you know, yeah. Why? And I don't know if that's, I'm so insulated that I don't know if that's strictly an American thing or.
Yeah. I'm not sure either.
Yeah. Because
there are plenty of people who listen to this show from around the world. So please let us know.
There you go. Yeah, I think there's, we go back to that basic minimum income that if people are free to create, like, so is there more, less insecurity somewhere where somebody knows their healthcare is being taken care of and their food bills are being paid? Does that free them to play viola in a quartet, you know, like, and how important is that? It's very important, you know, if that's what that person is called to do.
Right. Right. Yeah. And it's important for the rest of us because we get to listen to it.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, we get to experience the fruits of that creative effort. And it all,
amen.
You know, it's funny because I feel like if you take that to its logical conclusion, you end up with this creative utopia where everyone is automatically well compensated and we all just sit around making art for each other.
Yeah.
And I feel like, you know, even as I'm thinking it, I can hear the voices of people, and that's not ever going to happen, and we couldn't survive that way, and that's delusional and whatever. And it, you know, it probably is because human beings aren't perfect. But, you know, even if we got halfway there,
right,
or a quarter of the way there, I think as a whole, human beings will be a lot happier and treat each other better than we do now.
Yes. And as far as it's almost like I even am hesitant to say this, but struggle creates great art. So there always has to be a little bit of, you know, like there has to be a little pushback, a little friction, whether it be I'm worried about paying these bills or my, you know, significant other left me. That's where beautiful stuff comes from. So it's all part and parcel of that. So you'll never eradicate that struggle. And that's not a bad thing.
No.
It's because in the end, I truly believe it's all worth it. Going back to Alan Watts, you know, he says, just, you ever think about why all this exists as opposed to it doesn't exist at all? You know, that's the simplest basic question. And that question enough should drive you enough to keep you going to saying, this all exists for some reason. I should make a song. I should do a painting. You know what I mean? As opposed to there being nothing. It's a very weird, like, basic question, but there's a lot of truth in that.
Yeah.
There's something going on here. Isn't it worth the struggle? Isn't it worth pouring your passion into this?
Yeah.
Right?
Well, and I keep thinking the one quote of his that that springs to mind, because I haven't listened or read to as much of him as I would like to have, but a couple of years ago, I was listening to one of his lectures, and he was talking about how, you know, we always say we want to know the future, but do we really? Like, yeah. If we knew when we sat down to play Monopoly with our family, who was going to win, he argues, you'd put the game away. Because what's the point?
You are right.
And I think the same thing is kind of true here, right? Like, you don't know what's going to happen if you pick up a paintbrush or sit down at a keyboard or, you know, open your mouth to sing or audition or something. You've no idea what's going to happen. And right. The fact that you don't know is what makes it so interesting. And I know the exact quote you're talking about.
It's fascinating.
You could sit down and say, I want to see if I can make a copy of Van Gogh's Sunflowers, right?
Yeah.
And say, this is what I'm going to make. And it turns out that something in you wants to turn left when Van Gogh turned right, and you end up with something totally different that you didn't see coming when you sat down to do it.
That is expressly yours,
yeah.
Even though it was copying something else.
Right.
But you're right. It's funny. He said about tic-tac-toe, is the worst game ever because whoever starts wins the game. Like, it's, do you know what I mean? Like, it's really almost all the time. And even coin tossing, if you toss a coin 500 times, it will come up 250 times to almost all right. the time. But he said, if you're only going to toss it 50 times, then the game becomes interesting, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I know exactly what you're talking about. Like, you don't know what's going to happen. Kind of like improv theater, improv comedy, you know? Paint nights are so wonderful. They're so hot right now. People just go and they're like, we're going to do a painting. I've never painted before. That's okay. Have a glass of wine and here's a canvas. Like, those are awesome, right?
Yeah. One of these days I'm going to do one of those because they fascinate me.
They do, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, part of it is just the joy of I could sit down with this cheap little, you know, set of watercolors that I bought at Target and end up with a complete disaster. But I could sit down and come up with something that I really like, even if I don't know what it is.
Oh, yeah, right.
You know,
absolutely.
Be like, you know, show it to somebody. They say, what is it? I don't know, but I think it's cool.
I don't know.
I don't know. It's just what happened.
Yeah.
It's cool, though. You know, and they may say, uh-huh, if you say so. Or they may agree with you. You don't know, right? And that's
right.
That's the whole thing. It's like, it's an adventure just to sit down and see what that part of you comes up with, especially if you haven't been in touch with it before or for a long time. You know,
yeah.
I kind of wonder, like, when you sat down to do those two drawings, you know, were you really sure what was going to come out?
No, and they both look completely different than I expected. And I'm still proud of them.
Right.
You know, there's that part of me, I'm old enough to shove it down. That part of me is like, this is not what it should have looked like this. Now I'm just happy with it. Because I did it and it was for my wife and she was thrilled. So, you know, but 20 years ago, it would have been like, no, there would have been 50 crumpled watercolor sheets on the desk because no, that's not what it's supposed to look like. And that's good. I mean, some people have visions, I get it, but this was more just, this is who I am on paper. There was no, you know, professional training ever other than the one semester I spent in art school 35 years ago, you know. There's you know, different kinds of art, right?
And in fairness, that voice comes up for everybody. So if you are looking at the watercolor going, what in the heck is this? You could very easily give into that voice that's like, this is a piece of crap. You know,
What is that voice?
I think that voice is the perfectionist, maybe the parent who said that to you when you were a kid. And it could also be a cultural thing, right? Like, we're used to, you know, you go to the museum and the things that are in there are like the pinnacle of the art world. You don't see Monet's crappy early drafts.
Right? Absolutely.
I mean, unless you're really into him and you go digging. right? You're never going to see that. You don't hear the first crappy song that John Lennon and Paul McCartney ever wrote that they never recorded. You don't see that stuff. And so we judge ourselves according to the professional stuff we see, and then we get mad at ourselves because we sit down to try something for the first time and that's not what comes out. And that's also something that stops a lot of people. I know it's certainly stopped me when I've tried new things and I just sit there and I go, I have no idea what even to do with this.
But again, it's fear.
Right.
Fear drives everything, right?
It's fear and comparison and judgment.
Exactly.
The holy trinity of what will kill your creative process. The unholy trinity, really.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
The unholy trinity. I like that. Yep.
Yeah. And if you let that stuff stop you, then you end up in that place where you're just cranky all the time and you don't know why.
Well, it goes back to what I said about hostility. Mm-hmm. If you feel like there's something, an all watchful eye saying, you know, you must do it this way, as opposed to just being connected, that fear is
right.
I'm a failure. This is not, you know.
Yeah, which is why your I'm going to play the song I don't know thing is so brilliant.
So I had an idea at the beginning of the podcast that just came to me. I did not think of this before. And it's your podcast. I'll let you judge. But you should request a song and you should let me go get my guitar and try to play.
Oh, boy. Oh, boy.
Do you want to try to do that?
It should be something you don't know, right?
No, it has to be, at least have to know how the song goes.
Have to at least know how the song goes. Okay.
So, you know, pop and rock and classics. I'll leave it up to you. If you don't want to do this, it's fine. But I just had, when we were talking about at the beginning, I'm like, this would be a great way to end this podcast. Like,
it have would. You requested? I love it.
Yeah. Now, I don't know how my mic would pick up through Zoom. I've done it before, so I'm sure it would work. Do you want to think while I go grab my acoustic?
Yeah, I do.
Okay, I'm going to take the earbuds out so we can use the computer mic. I literally just thought of this at the beginning.
Yeah, no, it's a great idea. So for everyone who has not heard the last 15 minutes of us attempting to make that work, we could not make it work so that you could actually hear the guitar over Zoom, unfortunately. We were going to try to do Ticket to Ride and we failed, but we have just said the next time that I'm back out in York, we'll get together and see what we can do. So,
but you have to pick a different song now because I know what it is and I could secretly back with it. So it has to be something different.
I mean,
it's all good.
Fair enough. But in any case, this has been a ton of fun as always.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome. I'm glad you brought it up and we
I
made
love
it
talking
happen,
about art,
as always.
Making art and talking about art. So I appreciate you.
Likewise. That's this week's show. Thanks so much to Dominic Shortino for joining me and to you for listening. Please leave a review for this episode. There's a link right in your podcast app. And in it, tell us about your experience with art and commerce. If you enjoyed our conversation, I hope you'll share it with a friend. Thanks so much. If this episode resonated with you, or if you're feeling a little bit less than confident in your creative process right now, join me at The Spark on Substack as we form a community that supports and celebrates each other's creative courage. It's free, and it's also where I'll be adding programs for subscribers and listeners. The link is in your podcast app, so sign up today. See you there, and see you next week. Follow Your Curiosity is produced by me, Nancy Norbeck, with music by Joseph McDade. If you like Follow Your Curiosity, please subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to tell your friends. It really helps me reach new listeners.